Case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in Ford Motor Credit Company against Milholland. Mr. Burke, I think you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. The issue in these cases is whether or not the contractual right of acceleration in a consumer credit contract must be disclosed under the Truth in Lending Act or Regulation Z promulgated by the Federal Reserve Board. The right of acceleration is not mentioned anywhere as a specific disclosure requirement of the Act or the regulation. In fact, acceleration isn't mentioned anywhere in any provision of the Act or the regulation. The respondents have relied on two different sections of the regulation in an effort to glean a requirement on the part of the petitioners to disclose the acceleration clause. In the district court, the respondents relied upon section 226.8b4 dealing with default charges, and I'll come to that section in more detail in a moment. In the Court of Appeal, the Ninth Circuit, the respondents focused heavily upon 226.8b7, which was not raised in the district court, which deals with the creditor's rebate policy upon prepayment of a pre-computed consumer credit contract. The facts in the case are simple and, for the most part, are undisputed. The Milhollands and Mrs. Eaton entered into conditional sale contracts with the petitioners for the purchase of motor vehicles. The contracts were immediately assigned to Ford Motor Credit Company. The contracts have provisions on both the front and the back side, with the front side serving as the petitioner's disclosure statement required by the Truth in Lending Act and Regulation Z. The front side clearly disclosed all default charges imposed by the petitioners in paragraph 12. Paragraph 14 advised the respondents that in the event they prepaid the consumer credit contract for any reason at any time, whether or not there was a default and acceleration, the consumer would receive a rebate in full of all unearned finance charges. This is consistent, by the way, with the Oregon rebate statute, which requires such a rebate, and was followed by the creditors, as the record indicates, at all times relevant. The contract contained a default clause, which contained the usual creditor remedies, including the right of acceleration. This clause was set forth clearly in paragraph 19 of the contract on the reverse side, but was not separately repeated on the front side of the contract with the disclosure provisions of the Truth in Lending Act. The district court could find no provision of the Act or the regulation requiring the disclosure of acceleration clauses. However, it held that the acceleration clause should be disclosed under the spirit of the Act. Henceforth, all creditors are required to do so.
When you say disclose, just what do you embrace in that? Is it the manner in which it's made known, or is it the matter of making it known or not making it known?
Well, the provisions of the Truth in Lending Act require certain types of disclosures of contractual provisions in consumer credit contracts. As an example, the prepayment disclosure, essentially what the Act and the regulation require is that the creditor provide on the front side and on one page a disclosure of its prepayment rebate policy. So when we talk about disclosures, we're talking about certain specific enumerated provisions of the Act and the regulation that must be put together on one side and on one piece of paper of the contract.
Is it the regulation that requires the one side?
Yes, 226.6A, Mr. Justice Stewart.
That's not in the statute, but it is.
It's in section 226.6A. Now, the respondents fell into default under the contracts. After efforts by Ford Motor Credit to bring the contracts current failed, the vehicles were repossessed, and these Truth in Lending actions followed by the petitioners, by the respondents against the petitioners. The Ninth Circuit, in its decision, held that disclosures of acceleration clauses are never required under section 226.8b4. the default charge provisions of Regulation Z. However, the court held that when a creditor accelerates payments, accelerates the contract, exercises the right of acceleration, that demand for payment is itself a prepayment, and therefore was able to hold under 226.8B7 that the creditor must disclose whether it rebates unearned finance charges upon acceleration, not prepayment. In the process, the Ninth Circuit rejected the Federal Reserve Board's official staff interpretation of its own regulation. I might point out here that Section 226.8B7, dealing with prepayment, which is the basis of the Ninth Circuit decision below, has no counterpart in the Act. This is a provision only in the regulation and has been interpreted by the Federal Reserve Board through its official staff interpretation. We submit that a careful analysis of the applicable sections of the regulation and application of the Federal Reserve Board's official staff interpretation and substantial policy considerations dictate that the court's decision below should be reversed. The Federal Reserve Board has issued an official staff interpretation concerning the disclosure requirements incident to an acceleration clause. With respect to B4, which is reprinted in full in our opening brief, that requires that the creditor disclose the amount or method of computing the amount of any default delinquency or similar charges that are payable in the event of late payment. The language in the Act is very similar. The Federal Reserve Board has concluded in its official staff interpretation that the right of acceleration is a creditor remedy. It's a contract right. It's not an amount that can be disclosed, nor is it payable with the late payment of contract installments. What the board concluded in its OSI is that the right of acceleration need not be disclosed, that what's referred to in B4 is specific pecuniary charges that are payable with late payments of the type disclosed fully by the petitioners in this case in paragraph 12 of their contract. I might note right here that this issue has been considered by 7 circuit courts, and virtually every circuit court has unanimously agreed with the board on this issue, that the right of acceleration need not be disclosed under Section B4. There's no conflict on that point. The board has also concluded in its OSI that as long as the creditor rebates unearned finance charges upon prepayment after acceleration, in the same manner that it rebates upon voluntary prepayment, no default charge disclosures are required. And it's clear from the record in this case that that practice is followed in these cases.
Is it in the same manner or in no less burdensome
manner? No less burdensome manner. You're right, Mr. Justice Stewart. We submit, therefore, that the petitioner's forms in these cases comply with the provisions of the Act and the regulation as interpreted by the Federal Reserve Board and its official staff interpretation. This, incidentally, is the position that the United States has taken in its brief that it filed at the invitation of the court. I might point out on B7 that the official staff interpretation's position with respect to B7 is that a creditor need only disclose its rebate practice in general. It need not disclose what its rebate practice is and by specifically spelling out acceleration, as long as it makes a general rebate disclosure of its rebate agreement with respect to prepayment, that is sufficient.
Here the manner was what, some of the digits or some such thing?
Rule of 78, some of the digits, interchangeably.
S-U-M of the digits.
Yes, S-U-M.
Not S-O-M-E.
We submit that the board's official staff interpretation should be followed. The decisions of this court have consistently held that an agency's interpretation of its own regulation, which is what's involved here, should be deferred to as long as it is not plainly erroneous, or as long as there are no compelling indications of error. The agency's interpretation of its own regulation need not be the only possible construction of the regulation, nor even what a court might consider to be the preferable construction, as long as it's not plainly erroneous. We also submit that acceptance of the OSI in this case will further substantial policy considerations and will promote and facilitate the single most important purpose of the Truth in Lending Act, and that is to facilitate comparison shopping for credit by consumers. How will it do this? It will do it because it will facilitate comparison shopping for credit because disclosures can at last be uniform if interpretive responsibility is placed with a central agency, here the Federal Reserve Board, rather than scattered among trial and appellate courts across the land. It will also facilitate comparison shopping for credit because disclosures can be made simple and shorter and uniform and more understandable to consumers. Once creditors realize that they can place a high degree of reliance upon the board and staff interpretations of their own regulation, they will no longer feel compelled to provide the lengthy and complex disclosure forms that are now provided in an effort to anticipate and fend off litigation of this type. Respondents in their briefs have urged this court to amend the staff interpretation and to equate acceleration with prepayment. With this amendment in place, they claim that under B7, the creditor must disclose whether it rebates unearned finance charges upon acceleration. The first problem with this argument is that acceleration and prepayment are distinct concepts. They're not the same. They're logically and legally antithetical. An acceleration is a demand for payment. It's not in any sense of the word a prepayment, as claimed by the respondents. The respondents have not cited any provision of the Act or the regulation, or any other authority for that matter, to support their argument that acceleration and prepayment are identical.
Well, when the demand is complied with, it's prepayment, isn't it?
If there is a prepayment following acceleration, that, the board has said, is essentially a prepayment. That's correct.
Well, it is a prepayment. Compulsory, perhaps.
A payment following acceleration is a prepayment.
In response to a demand.
That's right. But, Mr. Justice Stewart,
voluntary.
The exercise of the right of acceleration may lead to a prepayment, but it itself is not a prepayment.
I see your point.
The respondents have failed to demonstrate, or even really attempt to demonstrate in their briefs, that the board's official staff interpretation is plainly erroneous. Petitioners submit that the OSI is a reasonable construction by the Federal Reserve Board of its own regulation and should be followed. In response to the alternative disclosure rule that the respondents have asked this court to accept, I can't put it any better than this court did in the Morning case, a case also dealing with Regulation Z. And I quote, "That some other remedial provision might be preferable is irrelevant. We have consistently held that where reasonable minds may differ as to which of several remedial measures should be chosen, courts should defer to the informed experience and judgment of the agency to whom Congress delegated appropriate authority." The Solicitor General will now present the views of the United States for 10 minutes, and I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you.
Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. I don't want to repeat what Mr. Burke has said. I think that he has made out a compelling case on the statute and under Regulation Z for the correctness of the Board's official staff interpretation, FC0054, which is set forth at pages 52 through 56 of the appendix to the petition. If, as we submit, the Court concludes that this official staff interpretation of the Board has correctly construed the Act and Regulation Z with respect to the disclosure of acceleration clauses and the rebate policy on payment of unearned finance charges upon payment after acceleration, I think it's clear that the judgment below has to be reversed. What I would like to describe briefly for the Court, it's set forth in greater detail in petitioner's reply brief in the appendix to his reply brief, is the process pursuant to which official staff interpretations are issued. The court in the Morning case has indicated that where reasonable minds may differ as to which of several remedial methods should be chosen, courts should defer to the informed judgment of the agency. And here the agency that Congress has vested authority to promulgate rules and regulations is the Federal Reserve Board. The part of the Federal Reserve Board that deals with the Truth in Lending Act is the Office of Consumer Affairs of the Federal Reserve Board. And these official staff interpretations are the product of a specialized group of people within the staff of the board, which are expert in the area of consumer credit. We think that's why they ought to be entitled to great deference. To begin with, let me say at the outset, before I begin to describe the process, that Congress itself has recognized that official staff interpretations of the board are such that they ought to be given deference. In 1974, Congress amended the Truth in Lending Act to provide for civil and criminal immunity if a person acts in good faith reliance upon the board's interpretation. But 2 years later, Congress determined that good faith reliance on the board's interpretation was insufficient, and they extended the immunity to good faith conformity with any interpretation or approval by a duly authorized official or employee of the Federal Reserve System. In our view, this 1976 amendment demonstrates a congressional vote of confidence in the quality and reliability of these official staff interpretations. And the process, which is set forth in the appendix to the petitioner's reply brief, we think confirms the correctness of this congressional vote of confidence. Official staff interpretations are issued in response to inquiries by private parties, either debtors or creditors, to the Federal Reserve Board. And when the inquiry comes in, the matter is assigned to a staff attorney to prepare a draft. Now this, the reason I'm going into this in great detail is because the other side has characterized these official staff interpretations as the work of a lone attorney or a lone board employee. And really nothing could be further from the truth, because the draft is prepared by a lone person, but then the process involves a very deep and detailed consultation with other staff attorneys, section chiefs, and officials of the Consumer Affairs Office of the Federal Reserve System. After this, the matter is then discussed with various officials who have demonstrated familiarity with the particular problem, and the official staff interpretation is only issued after further review by a section chief and approval by two officials of the Consumer Affairs Office of the Federal Reserve Board. Now, this is not the end of the matter, because then the official staff interpretation is sent to the Federal Register for publication. And in 1977, when this official staff interpretation was the one at issue here, was promulgated, the board then had a practice of issuing some OSIs with immediate effective dates and some with delayed effective dates. But the implication was the same. That is, that the public was entitled to make comments. And by the public, I mean not only the community of consumers, but the banking community and the people who lend in the consumer credit area. This particular OSI was issued with an immediate effective date, but there was a provision, as I said, for reconsideration upon request. There was no request for reconsideration of this OSI. Now, all OSIs were then and now reviewed quarterly by a Consumer Affairs Committee, which is a committee of members of the Federal Reserve Board itself, who have been assigned oversight responsibility over the work of the Office of Consumer Affairs, I think it's called Community and Consumer Affairs now, of the Federal Reserve Board. Now, as of April 1978, the board amended its procedure to provide for a delayed effective date of 30 days with respect to all official staff interpretations and a period of public comment. And the period of public comment is useful to provide the board with input from people who are affected by these technical interpretations. Between August 1976 and April 1978, 147 OSIs were issued under Regulation Z. Six were reconsidered pursuant to request, and none were changed. Under the new procedure, where everything gets a delayed effective date, 20 official staff interpretations have been issued, 9 have been reconsidered, and again, none have been changed. The point that we think is important here for the court is that this entire process is marked by very careful consideration, and it's the product of the special expertise of a group of highly trained people who have demonstrated deep familiarity with the consumer credit field. It's important that these official staff interpretations receive deference because, as counsel for the petitioner has properly pointed out, these technical questions require authoritative answers by a central authority. And indeed, the disarray in this case is indicative of the problems that arise. We now have five or six different circuits who have expressed themselves on the question of prepayment on the unearned finance charge disclosure policy, and have each indicated slightly different ways that they would go about providing for this disclosure.
Now, this, Smith, at this point, with all this disarray, the board hasn't really done very much by way of rulemaking to straighten out the disarray, have they?
Well, the board has spoken in OSI FC0054, which it believes is the.
But nothing by formal rulemaking.
Nothing by formal rulemaking, although, Mr. Justice Blackmun, I would think that once the litigation commenced on this issue, it might have been inappropriate for the board then to
well,
speak
theory, the
by
more
regulation.
Disarray, the less the agency is going to do.
Well, yes, but I mean the point I think that I'm making is that if this court holds as we submit it should, that official staff interpretations are entitled to deference, I think a lot of this technical kind of litigation over very small questions under the Act, small disclosure questions, will cease, because I think the statistics in the briefs have indicated that the volume of truth in lending litigation has mushroomed enormously as people have challenged the propriety of a variety of questions of disclosure under the Act.
The courts rather typically and frequently have simply disregarded the OSIs, haven't they?
Yes, I think not. I think not. My understanding is they generally have followed them, and that only in this case is I think an unusual instance where there has been a wide variety of judicial rulemaking,
in this area.
But I think, as our brief points out, generally they have been given the deference that we think they deserve. And what I want to say in closing is simply that this judicial disarray has, in our view, hampered enforcement by the various agencies that are given the enforcement powers under the Act. Because while private debtors or consumers can bring actions under the Act, a variety of agencies, such as the Federal Trade Commission, the Comptroller of the Currency, and they're all set forth in 15 U.S.C. 1607, have been given responsibility by Congress according to the kind of creditor to enforce the Act. Now, these agencies necessarily have to look to and rely upon the official staff interpretations of the board. And if they can't do that, then I think that the uniformity that Congress sought to impose in this area will be severely hampered. The court has no questions. I have nothing further.
All right, Mr. Smith. Mr. Schlossy.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. I represent the respondents in this case, Dennis and Michelle Milholland and Ms. Donna Eaton, who are the consumers.
Could I ask an irrelevant question at this point? Is your client's name misspelled all the way through on the court records?
The Milholland spell it with two L's, and we have spelled it with one L throughout the litigation, from the district court through the Ninth Circuit up to and including all the briefs.
And they haven't discharged you yet.
They haven't discharged me yet.
It isn't M-U-L.
It's M-I-L. It is Milholland.
So it's all right for you to stay with the misspelling.
That's correct. Thank you. And Ms. Donna Eaton, these were two separate transactions who purchased their automobiles from Ford Motor Credit Company. I would like to just add one additional fact that was not brought out by the petitioner, and that is the Milhollands were two payments late on their contract when, without prior notice, Ford Motor Credit repossessed their automobile. On the same day as the repossession, the Milhollands offered to pay Ford Motor the exact amount of the delinquent payments. In fact, Ford Motor denied this and indicated that they accelerated the unpaid balance and they demanded the entire unpaid balance of the contract. There are three points which I would like to make to the court this afternoon. First, all of the parties concerned, Federal Reserve Board staff, the Solicitor General, the consumers, and Ford Motor Credit, agree that in a contract like the one signed by the consumers, in this case, the effect on the finance charge of the process of acceleration is important information to be disclosed to the consumers under the provisions of the Tooth and Lending Act and Regulation Z. Second, the consumers could prevail in this case under either the views expressed by the Federal Reserve Board staff or the rationale of the court below. We think that the lower court's opinion is the better rule since, unlike the views of the Federal Reserve Board staff, it consistently guarantees the disclosure of meaningful information to the consumer in all credit transactions. And third, the Federal Reserve Board itself has not made known its position on this matter.
Mr. Slotty, I don't mean to get anecdotal about this, but supposing you have the most consumer-oriented court or board in the world, and it's trying to figure out what has to be disclosed and what hasn't. I can remember a committee I served on drafting a Truth in Land Sales Act, and we were following a model of a state which had a three-page list of requirements that had to be disclosed. One of them, in a particular disclosure, was that during periods of high water, all or parts of this lot may be underwater. It didn't prevent the lot from selling at all. You would have thought, whereas had it been limited to just a few very important things, it might have prevented the lot from selling. I would think that from a consumer's point of view, you would want a limited but important category of information disclosed, and not just every conceivable thing you can think of.
I certainly agree with Your Honor, and in fact it has been raised by some people that what in fact the Truth in Lending Act is doing is making disclosure statements more confusing rather than simpler. And I have several answers to that remark. The first is, and if you will look at the Joint Appendix, page 9 and 10, the majority of the provisions on a contract are not those required by the Truth in Lending Act and Regulation Z. Rather, they're terms that are inserted by the creditors themselves. And it's those extra terms that are the terms that are causing the contracts to become longer and more confusing.
But isn't it from fear of litigation like this that they insert them?
No, Your Honor. The disclosures that are on the face of the contract or on a separate document, they don't necessarily have to be on the contract, are fairly limited in their scope. In this case, the petitioners could have remedied the violation by simply adding two words to their disclosure, which would have given the meaningful information to the consumer that they needed prior to entering the contract to be able to judge the effect on the credit, on the cost of credit, should they default, should the contract be accelerated. The Solicitor General has stated several times in his brief that the Federal Reserve Board has, in fact, issued an official interpretation on this, and to this extent, the Solicitor General is mistaken. The only interpretation that has been issued is an official staff interpretation, and there have been three unofficial staff opinions that have been issued, but there has been no board interpretation. And this is, in fact, the reason that the confusion among the circuits and the various disarray in the circuits has been created. Is the Federal Reserve Board, granted as the agency authorized by Congress to implement the Truth in Lending Act, has failed to issue an interpretation which will solve the confusion, which will answer the questions, which will tell consumers and creditors alike what disclosures have to be made. In that situation, it is natural that the courts have stepped in, taken over for the Federal Reserve Board itself, and tried to remedy the situation, and they've come up with six or seven differing theories.
Why don't they follow the OSIs?
There's been one OSI, official staff interpretation, that was issued, and that was FC 54.
Have the courts of appeals followed that?
We've had basically three different positions. You've had the Ninth Circuit position, which didn't follow it. You had several other circuits which followed it completely, and several others which say truth disclosures never have to be made about acceleration. But I'll explain the problem to you with the OSI. The Ninth Circuit and the Federal Reserve Board official interpretation basically agree that the process of acceleration can affect the cost of credit in that an early termination of the contract will affect the amount of the finance charge that's going to be rebated, and that is information to be disclosed to the consumer. That is the basis of the official staff interpretation, and that is the basis of the Ninth Circuit opinion. Where the two-part company is on the situations when that disclosure has to be made to the consumer. Federal Reserve Board staff is concerned with the effect on the consumer of acceleration, whereas the Ninth Circuit is concerned with the information that will be given to the consumer about acceleration and its effect on the finance charge. And I think a good example is represented by 54. One of the purposes of the Truth in Lending Act, and was indicated by the petitioner, is to promote comparative credit shopping by consumers. If you take Official Staff Interpretation 54 and apply it to a common situation with two creditors, consumer is going out, is trying to shop for credit, decide which is going to be the best credit deal for that consumer. If these two creditors rebate upon acceleration or payment after acceleration by exactly the same method, but they differ as to prepayment, such that one creditor rebates by the same method in both situations, and the other creditor differs, the first creditor will only have to disclose the prepayment method. The second creditor will have to disclose both the prepayment method and the method for acceleration. The consumer will look at those contracts, and despite the fact that both creditors rebate upon acceleration by the same method, will see only one rebate disclosure for acceleration. The consumer would reasonably believe that the first creditor has a better deal for him or her because there is no indication about any finance charge rebate or lack thereof on acceleration. And there's no way that a consumer could reasonably meaningfully comparative shop in that situation.
Well, they could by reading paragraph 19, I suppose.
On the reverse of the contract. And that's one of the things that the Regulation Z says, is that if you're going to have meaningful disclosure, the disclosure has to be on the face of the contract. And there's a very practical reason for that. Pardon?
If there's room.
Where do you draw the line with all these details?
It's very easy to have, for instance, a separate disclosure statement separate from the contract. In that case, the creditor can
have a bigger front page.
Pardon?
Have a larger and longer front page.
You could have a larger and longer front page, or in this situation, this is Ford Motors' contract, but a simple addition of two words would have provided that consumer with the information that they needed.
You mentioned that before. Where would you put the two words in?
I put the two words down in paragraph 14. It says, buyer may prepay his obligations, etc., upon prepayment or acceleration. Buyer will receive a rebate of the unearned finance charge. Or acceleration would be the adequate disclosure.
Do you really think many automobile purchasers would be motivated to go out and compare contracts on the basis of those two words being added? Do you really think so?
I think, in fact, they will, Your Honor. And
have you ever known a purchaser of an automobile to read all the fine print in one of these contracts?
Maybe a fleet purchaser, but I don't know about a little ordinary purchaser.
Reading the fine print on the contract is exactly the problem. Most purchasers do not read the fine print on the contract,
right,
which was the entire rationale for the Truth in Lending Act, put it on the front. So, Mr.
You
Chief
think
Judge,
just you fine think on the front. You don't call that big print that you just showed us.
Well, this is a slightly, in the appendix, it's reduced down for the purpose of the appendix.
It still looks like a lot of fine print to me.
Compared to the back of the contract, it's very large.
Well, if it's a bigger print in real life, it's a longer page, too.
What?
I think the size of the print is the same, and there's a little more space between the lines.
I don't think the size of the print is the issue. The issue is to put the required disclosures, that credit information, which is important for the consumer, in one location at a certain time before the contract is entered, so that it can be easily read and understood. You obviously can't legislate wise credit shopping, but what you can legislate, is the information to give the consumer the ability to make the wise credit shopping. And when you bury an acceleration clause and its effect on the finance charge on the reverse of the contract, you're taking away that ability for the majority of the consumers.
Counselor, you just said something about it being easily understood. I read you paragraph 14, which is the one you're centering on. Buyer may prepay his obligations under this contract in full or at any time prior to maturity of the final installment hereunder, and if he does so, shall receive a rebate of the unearned portion of the finance charge, computed under the sum of the digits method after first deducting an acquisition fee of $15. You think that's readily understood by the average
I think it's understood except for the sum of the digit method, which, if you read most state statutes, is really confusing. The fact that issue has been litigated in several circuits, and the rationale behind upholding that disclosure is that the alternative to saying Rule of 78 for some of the digit methods is a disclosure which is just as complicated and much, much more lengthy. Putting out the mathematical formula or explanation of the Rule of 78 is not going to provide meaningful information to anybody, lawyers, judges, mathematicians, accountants. The alternative in this case is simply two- or three-word disclosure on the contract. There's certainly no such adverse consequences.
An ordinary buyer would know what the word acceleration means, except in the connection with the car. You put your foot on the foot feed.
That's one of the principal advertising factors of cars, that it will accelerate from 0 to 40 miles an hour in 18 and a half feet.
It may be a first-year law student might eventually learn what acceleration is under on a note, but it isn't an article of nature, is it?
I agree, but putting acceleration or some term other than acceleration that explains the consequences of the fault, it certainly has to be better. It has to give more information to the consumer than simply having prepay and assuming that the consumer is going to understand that the term prepay also encompasses the concept of acceleration after default. More consumers are going to think that prepay means a voluntary payment prior to the maturity of the contract, as indeed the contract indicates prepayment has to be made before maturity of the final installment. If you have acceleration or payment after acceleration or payment of the entire unpaid balance in conjunction with an explanation of the rebate, that is information that a consumer is going to have a better chance of understanding.
Mr. Slotty, I hate to be slow on this, but frankly I am. You said to us two or three times, you only have to add two or three words, and you said you add them somewhere in paragraph 14. I can't figure out where you add them, and I think you really have to rewrite the whole paragraph and make it much longer.
Well, in fact, you may have to change the words around in the paragraph.
So it isn't just a matter of adding two words, then, is it?
Well, in a number of contracts, it would be a matter of simply adding or
acceleration. But in this contract, you know, we have to start somewhere. It would have to be rewritten with an additional contingency described, namely acceleration. You can't just throw the words or accelerate in the thing as it's written now. At least I can't. And I don't think you can.
I could change the words around in the paragraph very slightly to make it put or acceleration or payment after acceleration.
Well, you can just add a sentence saying the same terms shall be applicable to prepayment after a demand, after an acceleration demand.
Exactly, Your Honor. Second problem with staff interpretation 54 is it doesn't answer the question of what to do when the contract has a prepayment disclosure on the front and an acceleration clause on the back that says that the creditor has the right to accelerate the unpaid balance, but does not disclose the method by which that rebate of the finance charge will be made. And what the staff has said in this situation is you look to undisclosed, non-binding creditor policy to determine what, in fact, the creditor will do. You basically say, what is the policy of the creditor? If the policy of the creditor, regardless of the contract term, is to rebate the same as for prepayment, then no disclosure has to be made. If the policy of the creditor is to rebate for other than prepayment, then they have to make a separate disclosure. Now, there are numerous problems with this. The first is, how is the consumer, the person whom the Act is intended to protect, going to be able to determine what the undisclosed policy of a creditor is? Second, that policy is not binding. It's a non-written, undisclosed policy. It's not binding on the creditor, and it's not binding on the creditor's assignee. And that, in fact, frustrates the enforcement mechanism of the Act. It was indicated by the Solicitor General that private consumers are, in fact, a primary enforcement mechanism of the Act. Since acceleration, a rebate of the finance charge, is not going to occur until there is a default, and that is when the policy of the creditor will, in fact, become known, that default may incur after a year, and the Act has a one-year statute of limitations. If it occurs after the year, the consumer is simply not going to have any remedy. The creditor, who has a non-binding policy, in fact, is going to be able to change that policy however they want. The record in this case indicates that Ford Motor changed their policy twice, in the Milholland case and in the Eaton case, but the contract disclosure stayed exactly the same. In the first case, the affidavit indicated that upon the act of acceleration, they rebated according to prepayment.
Does the record show how long the Ford Motor Company has been using this form?
I don't think it does, Your Honor, unless you look at the bottom of the contract, which will say that it's a certain edition, and I think it's 1973.
Any idea of how many contracts are outstanding?
How many contracts are outstanding? I assume that they number in probably the millions.
Right. Is it a contract that's fairly general in the industry, or is this unique to Ford Motor?
In the early 1970s, acceleration clauses were normally on the back of the contract rather than on the front, and that is, in fact, what fostered most of the litigation, which worked its way up to the circuits. It's not in the record now, but we deal with a lot of these contracts, and I think the normal rule now is to have the acceleration clause on the front of the contract rather than on the back. Creditors simply have not found that too much of a burden to change. And you raise an interesting point, because one of the suggestions that has been made is that if this court affirms the ruling of the Ninth Circuit or requires the disclosure of acceleration and its effect on the finance charge, it's instantly going to throw millions and millions of consumer contracts into default, and it's going to cost the credit industry untold millions of dollars. And it's simply not the case. There are two protections for the creditors in the Act. One protection is a one-year, very short, statute of limitations. You file your suit within 1 year from the date the contract is signed, or you're out of luck. For all those creditors that have violated Milholland or St. Germain, the year has run. They have no...
There's still millions within the year.
There's still been millions within the year.
Well, that's all you need, then.
There is
that would satisfy the complaint. There would be millions.
But there's a second protection to cover those millions, and that is the Act provides an absolute protection to the creditor who in good faith relies on any official staff interpretation issued by the Federal Reserve Board, despite the fact that that official staff interpretation is later revoked or rescinded by a court. So if this court affirms the Ninth Circuit, rejects the rationale of the official staff interpretation, those creditors who in good faith...
Was there a conflicting case in this? There was, wasn't there?
I'm sorry, I don't know.
Wasn't there a conflicting decision with the Ninth Circuit? Hasn't there been a court of appeals who decided this case another way?
There's been several courts of appeals who have interpreted the official staff interpretation different than the Ninth Circuit.
Well, what about in those circuits?
The rule would stay the same.
Any Why would it? It's been the court has struck it down in those circuits.
And while they haven't struck down the section of the Act that provides...
I don't know how you could... How could you rely in those circuits upon any staff interpretation that has been invalidated by a court?
Because the statute specifically says that creditor who in good faith relies on an official staff interpretation...
How can you be in good faith if the court has told you that you shouldn't, the staff interpretation is not worth a nickel?
For those creditors who relied on the staff interpretation after the circuit court opinion came down, I think I agree with you.
Well,
but for those who relied on it before...
I know, but that's been quite a while.
I'm sorry, quite a while from...
Well, there's been a long time go by since those cases have decided that the staff interpretation was wrong. There have been a lot of creditors who certainly since then wouldn't be able to rely.
The official staff interpretation in this case was in 1977.
Well, that's...
Now, any person...
How many millions have bought automobiles since then? Or even Ford?
Any creditor who relied on that staff interpretation would be protected regardless of a subsequent circuit court opinion.
I didn't say subsequent. How about relying on it after those cases? How about the ones who've relied on it since those courts who have struck it down?
And before the official staff interpretation.
No.
Right.
How does the average purchaser of an automobile even know about the staff interpretation?
They don't. They don't. They get their disclosures from the face of the contract.
Mm-hmm. But does your point have any significance then? That this is an out for the companies who have these contracts outstanding?
Well, I'm not sure what getting at.
That's all right. Forget it.
Well, my question may be equally, or my question may be off the mark. If what you tell us is true, why didn't that provision protect the creditor in this case who was relying on a staff interpretation?
Well,
prior to the court decision.
The Milholland decision, or the Milholland contract, was signed before the Act was amended to allow for that type of creditor defense.
I see.
There's no interpretation to rely upon, no Act of Protection.
How would one prove reliance? Let's try again. Suppose you had a client and you wanted to prove reliance, what would you have to show? That he'd read the Federal Register?
As a creditor, I had a client who was a creditor.
Right. Yes.
If I could put myself in that situation,
it would be difficult, would it?
Probably. I would show that in fact I had a department of my company that reviewed Truth in Lending as official staff interpretations and compared them with the contracts. And in a suit, I'd simply put on an affidavit or the testimony that says I in fact read this and I relied upon that when I drafted my contract. Whether that's going to be sufficient or not, I'm not sure, but I think that is what Congress intended when they, in fact, passed the Act. The Ninth Circuit has avoided these two particular problems, the one of undisclosed creditor policy for reliance and the one for comparative credit shopping by having a rule that consistently guarantees meaningful information to the consumer. And that is basically you always have to disclose the effect of the finance charge, the effect of acceleration on the finance charge rebate, whether or not it's the same for acceleration and or prepayment. That is the one way which the consumer will always be able to get the information they need.
There's no rule of law I've ever heard of that doesn't have close cases and that sort of thing that breed litigation. And I would suspect the Ninth Circuit's rule is the same. Are you suggesting that we adopt the Ninth Circuit's rule or that we leave the circuits free to interpret each circuit free to interpret for itself what deference it will give to Regulation Z?
I think that's the heart of the matter, Your Honor. I think we have the same interest in this case as Ford Motor does, and that is the Federal Reserve Board has not made known their position on this matter, and we want to get a uniform decision, something that everybody can rely upon. We think that the decision should be that, in accordance with the Federal Reserve Board staff interpretation, the effect of acceleration on the finance charge rebate is credit information that has to be disclosed to the consumer. And second, the rationale or the disclosure method that should be used is not that, as the Federal Reserve Board staff indicates, but that which the Ninth Circuit indicates.
So we follow part of the staff board interpretation, but not all of it.
Exactly.
Well, how do you reach that result? How does one justify reaching that result?
The deference that's to be accorded to a Federal Reserve or to an agency interpretation or the opinions of an agency depend on a number of factors. The thoroughness of evidence in its consideration, the validity of its reasoning, its consistency with prior and future pronouncements.
Did we put all those conditions on in the morning opinion?
It wasn't in the morning opinion. It was in another case, the Skidmore case, that had to do with it. The morning opinion had to do with the authority of the Federal Reserve Board to issue a regulation and whether they had that authority under the Act. And that's not the case here. We're talking about something different. We are not attacking the authority of the Federal Reserve Board to issue 226-8B7 or 226-8A. We think that 8B7 is perfectly proper. What we are questioning is the details of the application of the staff's interpretation of that particular regulation. I'd just like to say one other thing in closing, and that is it has been indicated that there have been a lot of truth in lending suits filed in the United States, and the number is significantly increasing. And the implication, though it hasn't been said directly, is that a number of these suits are frivolous. I have several comments to that. First is there's nothing in the record, and there's no citation to any cases that I know of that says anything that these increased number of truth in lending suits are, in fact, frivolous. In fact, I think what they may represent is the increase in consumer credit in the United States and the lack of creditor compliance with the terms of truth in lending. And I also mentioned something that this court stated just several months ago in Ryder versus Sonatone, which authorized private class actions under the Antitrust Act. That same concern was raised by Sonatone in that case, and the court said basically That's not an unimportant consideration, but the district court should be aware and vigilant for the frivolous suits, but it's up to Congress to provide adequate funds for judges to handle the Truth in Lending suits or to handle the suits that may arise under the Antitrust Act. I think the heart of the situation is not the deference to be accorded to the staff opinions, but whether or not in the application of those opinions the consumer is going to receive the meaningful information that they are entitled to under the terms of the Act and under the statements of this Court in Mourning. Thank you.
Have anything further, Mr. Burke?
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, I won't take much more of the Court's time to respond. I would like to address a couple of points that were raised by Mr. Slotty in his presentation. First of all, I do not want the Court left with the impression that the respondents were mistreated in this case. The joint appendix at pages 23 to 25 indicate the substantial efforts made by Ford to cause the Milholland's to bring their contract current, which failed. Mrs. Eaton advised Ford that she could no longer continue to make payments on the contract, so Ford accepted the vehicle in full discharge of the indebtedness and did not seek a deficiency judgment. In response to the questions by Mr. Justice Stevens, Mr. Slotty has said that the simple addition of two words would solve this problem. That is, the words were that you disclose that you will rebate upon prepayment or acceleration. Had we added those two simple words that Mr. Slotty says would have solved all the problems, we'd be here today with Mr. Slotty arguing, but you don't rebate upon acceleration. You have misadvised the consumer. You say you will rebate upon prepayment or acceleration. Your own affidavits show that you don't rebate on acceleration. You rebate upon payment following acceleration. And we'd be litigating that question here today. There's been no change in Ford Credit's policy on rebate, as the joint appendix shows at pages 22 and 68. I'd like to conclude by emphasizing the terrible dilemma facing the credit industry today. The dilemma is a central theme of the three amici curiae briefs filed by the Consumer Bankers Association, the California Bankers Association, the National Consumer Finance Association, joined by General Motors Acceptance Corporation. And that dilemma is the consumer credit industry wants to comply with the Truth in Lending Act and Regulation Z and is conscientiously attempting to do so. However, the problem is the industry can't place any substantial degree of reliance upon the board and staff interpretations if courts such as the court below refuse to pay deference to those interpretations. The industry can't afford to change their contract forms each time a new case comes down with an additional disclosure that that particular judge thought should be provided. And at the same time, they can't afford not to change their forms because of the punitive liability aspects of the Act, which could be ruinous to smaller creditors. As a result, what they're doing is the logical thing. They're over-disclosing in an attempt to anticipate and fend off legal challenges of the type raised here. The result is that the disclosure forms are long. I've seen forms that are 2 or 3 feet long. They're confusing. They're non-uniform. And that itself is a violation, or could be a violation, of the Act and the regulation. We submit that there's a simple way out. That is, if the official staff interpretation is followed and applied in this case, it will have two healthy effects. First, the board will be encouraged to continue to use its interpretive powers to attempt to bring some semblance of uniformity and simplicity into this area. This will benefit creditors, to be sure, but it will also benefit consumers, because the forms can be shorter and simpler and easier to understand if creditors know that they can place reliance upon the board's interpretive guidelines. The second beneficial effect of following the OSI in this case is it will permit the system to operate the way Congress and the board intended it to operate. That is, when the board or the staff publishes an OSI for comment in the Federal Register, creditors, consumers, any interested person will make their views known to the board at that time rather than to wait till subsequent litigation to attack the board's views. The board and staff can then assess the views and positions of all interested parties at that time, which will vastly improve its decision-making process. In short, it will no longer be possible for an interest group or person to sit back, allow an OSI to be published for comment, allow it to become final, allow the industry to rely upon it, and then attack it in a trial court action, attempting to convince a trial judge that the board could have done better, as was done in this case. We submit, therefore, for all of these reasons, that the decision of the court below should be reversed. Thank you very much.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted.
The court is now adjourned. adjourned until tomorrow at 10 o'clock.